everybody. I don't know if you went on a long tour yesterday or were in a two-day amazing workshop like me, but my brain is a little fried right now. But we're gonna have a great discussion about food system solutions, so thank you for coming. I'm really excited. I'm Jenny Splitter. I was like, what should I do next? Oh, I thought they were cheering for me. I was like, oh, they're going to cheer for me. Oh, my God, thank you. It's like, wow, that's never happened before. It turns out it's not happening now. But anyway, so I'm editor-in-chief of Sentient. We got this. Sentient, which is a nonprofit news outlet. We cover industrial animal ag and kind of its impact on everything. So the food system, health, climate emissions, environmental pollution, health, I said health already, policy, all that stuff. And we're very excited to be here and be talking about food. I'm not passing it because you guys have it. So yeah, let's just do like a brief introduction.
Sure. Hey, everybody. I'm Garrett Broad. I'm an associate professor at Rowan University, which is across the river in South Jersey. I'm a Philly guy, though, originally, and actually live in town. I'm a researcher and a teacher who focuses on issues related to food systems and social movements. I have done a lot of work on food access and food justice issues, as well as issues related to meat, animals, and the social and environmental impacts.
Greetings, everyone. My name is Malaika. And I am the co-founder and co-creator of One Art Community Center here in West Philadelphia. We have been around for, we're celebrating our 22nd year on the sacred land that we exist on for now. And I do work with herbs and with food, but mainly with the people. And I love what I do. I love that I get a chance to reconnect with the earth every day and also open pathways for others to connect as well.
Ooh. Hi, everyone. I'm Matt Scott. I am the Director of Storytelling and Engagement and the founding director of the Drawdown Stories Program at the global nonprofit Climate Solutions Resource Project Drawdown. And I think one of my strongest connections with the food system, other than the fact that Project Drawdown works to identify climate solutions, including some of the top climate solutions, like reducing food waste and plant-based diets and the like, that I'm the host and the creator of the climate solution short documentary series, Drawdown's Neighborhood, which has really given me an opportunity to go into so many different communities and interview and highlight people not only about the work that they do when it comes to food system solutions, which is a huge part of that, and I'm sure I'll share some reflections from that, but also just to really learn and celebrate who the people are who are leading these solutions forward, because so often we just talk about the solution and the science and the data, but the people are at the core of it, as we all know, and that's what I get to center in my work.
Thanks, Matt, and good morning, everyone. So my name is Fanny Yin. I also live in Philly, and I have a journalism background, covered science, health, and environment in newsrooms for several years, but have really sort of pivoted to focus on fisheries and seafood. So these days I am working on my own documentary podcast about Philly's local fish and people who love fish, but I also provide comms and media support for a couple fisheries seafood orgs. So one of them that I will be talking about a lot today is Fishadelphia. It is a community seafood program here in Philly, and we source sustainable local seafood directly from fishermen and shellfish farmers in New Jersey, and we bring it to the city on a sliding scale, so it's a way for people to practice that solidarity economy and mutual aid. And then I also work for a North American-wide nonprofit called the North American Marine Alliance. That is a grassroots network that's led by conservation-minded, small and medium-scale commercial fishing families. Our networks represent nearly 500,000 fishing families across North America who lead our work through decentralized organizing. Our work is really about building a broad movement for healthy ocean commons and just thriving fishing communities.
Great, thank you. We're mostly going to be talking about solutions, but I guess I did want to sort of set the stage with kind of what the problems are that these solutions attempt to solve. And I sort of have like all these stats, but now I feel like I don't want to just read stats at you. So I guess I'm just thinking more in terms of like some of the stats that people don't necessarily know. And one that's kind of come up for me, you know, being in the sort of climate disinfo workshop, I don't know if any of the rest of you were in that, but, you know, one of the things that came up a bunch of times was that, like, you know, at this point, most people know that, like, climate change is real and that climate change is a problem. But actually in the food system space, you know, even though, like, a quarter of emissions are caused by the food system, and most of that comes from, like, beef, actually, and it's the burps and it's the land use change. But there's been quite a few surveys that show that, like, a lot of people actually don't think that, like, just eating less meat and eating less dairy would, you know, actually be good for climate change. And I think the one I was just looking at was, like, a University of Maryland, Washington Post, and it was, like, something like 75, like, almost three quarters or something of the people surveyed. So I guess, like unlike, you know, climate, unlike sort of fossil fuels, I think there's actually not, it's a good opportunity for journalists, right? Like, I think a lot of readers don't actually know that connection. But we're going to talk about a lot more than emissions here, and part of the reason that, like, food is really complicated is that, you know, it's not just emissions, it's not just pollution, it's the people, workers, people, you know, food insecurity, people need to eat, animals, most of them are raised on factory farms, wildlife, like, there's so many impacts. And so I was thinking one, just to, like, mention a few of them, maybe it could be good to just say kind of, like, maybe one impact that you feel like, yeah, you know, maybe hasn't been well covered in the media, like, could be something that for journalists in the room, like, here's something that needs some more coverage, that might be a good place to start.
I think probably a lot of people know that our seafood industry and market is very globalized and almost impossible to trace in a lot of cases, but I'll just like maybe share some numbers that sort of help us understand. So I guess one thing too is, so fisheries have become really consolidated in the U.S. and everywhere, and I think, you know, one thing that I want to talk about in this panel, and I talked about a bit if you were on in my Wednesday workshop, is just that with that consolidation, fishing communities that have lived on the water for generations and who have really deep connections with the water, a lot of fisher folks have been displaced from that livelihood, and so that connection to their home waters has been really disrupted. So that's really a huge impact of the consolidation that goes hand in hand with how globalized the seafood system has become. But actually in the U.S., we actually land a lot of seafood, edible seafood. For every 7 pounds of seafood that the U.S. lands domestically, Americans consume 6 pounds. So we actually are landing more than Americans consume, which I think a lot of people don't realize. And 5 pounds of that is actually imported. So it's a kind of backward situation where we're landing actually plenty of fish. A lot of it is just underutilized species, so it's not necessarily like the shrimp, salmon, tuna, the few species that we all demand, you know, all year round, no matter where we are. It's less familiar species that are really delicious. But, you know, even though we're landing enough to feed people, we're still participating in this system where most of the seafood that you eat has, like, flown around the world before it lands on your plate.
I was going to say, I appreciate following you, Fanny, with that. Also, it's interesting because my lens of the impacts and kind of what I want to highlight is a bit different because so in the work that I do, it's, as I mentioned at the start, it's really focused on centering underrepresented communities, but through stories, through storytelling and engagement around those. And, you know, it doesn't need to be said, but it needs to be said constantly also at the same time that the communities most vulnerable to the impacts of the climate crisis But also least represented in climate dialogue are Black communities, Indigenous communities, and communities of color. And I'm going to say something that is so broad, but like the reality is that when we look at our food systems and actually how so many of our systems operate when it comes to, I won't even say our climate, but just how our communities work, that the impact that's most concerning to me is all the ways that we leave Black and brown communities behind and the ripple effects of that. So I'll talk more as we go along. Something I was reflecting on, which is all the benefits and all of the reasons why people do this work. Through my Drawdowns Neighborhood series, when I ask people why they choose to do the work they do, why they choose to work in climate careers or whatever careers they're working on, whether it's because of climate or not, very rarely do they start by mentioning climate. Very rarely do they start by mentioning the emissions. It's how can we support family? How can we create self-sufficiency for our communities, which I think is a huge one? How could we create workforce readiness and support workforce development? So those are some of the things that are top of mind for me when I think about our food systems. How could we make sure that we aren't just focusing on this bigger picture question of how do we stop climate change? Because some people are just trying to live today. A lot of people are just trying to live today. A lot of people are just trying to improve their communities. A lot of people are just trying to, you know, support their families and, like, honor their histories and legacies in ways that our current food system doesn't honor. And so that culture piece and that identity piece is something I really want to, I want folks to leave with because it matters.
Thank you. Wow, what an honor. It's such an honor to be on a panel with all of you. So amazing. And I just want to take a moment because I know that you've been in this conference and I have organized many conferences and multiple events every year. So let's just take a moment before I go into it and I'll balance it out. I'll keep my my share a little shorter. But just let's take a moment to ground ourselves, right? Because we're here together, we're here to support the work that can help us survive. So if you can place both feet on the ground, and just take a moment to breathe. So far, this conference has been so full, so much information. So let's breathe it in and give ourselves a moment to begin digesting. And breathing out, feeling our connection with Mama Earth beneath us, feeling gravity pulling us, keeping us strong. Breathing in and out, allowing this connection, observing this connection and honoring this connection. And knowing that at any point, any time throughout this conference in life, by taking a moment to breathe, we can reconnect. I think everyone that's here today, our work, there's a connection, right? You all are connecting the people with important information. And we each have our jobs. We're connecting with the people. We're connecting with the earth. And
And so to honor that connection is so important, right? Because that's where it all is. If we can't have an authentic connection, how can we report? How can we do the work fully if we don't have that? And to have that doesn't require a lot. It just requires a consciousness. And so I encourage us all, I encourage myself every day to have that connection and to honor it. One of the things that I want to share that has been really at the top of what's going on in our Philadelphia community as far as land justice work is it's revolving around the land bank. And so years ago, we fought as land stewards, as community people, land justice workers, food justice workers. We fought for this land bank to be instituted within Philadelphia. Because up until that point, there was a complete lack of transparency. A lot of our low-income neighborhoods, we are living next to vacant land. That would turn into very dangerous areas. And then we're like, hey, we're going to just start growing food on here. We're going to transform this. We're going to change the whole energy of our neighborhood by creating these safe spaces. And we were doing that. And then people would be joining and community organizing and growing food together. And then all of a sudden, someone would come by and say, hey, I'm buying this land for a dollar and turning it into whatever. And even folks who were wanting to purchase land, there was no transparent path. Outside of One Art and connected to One Art Community Center, there are 11 plots of land, and it was just vacant. People had been killed there. When we were cleaning up the land, we found bones, you know, like stuff that was, you know, just so, there was so much remediation, not just physically, but spiritually, to transform the land. And then it became this long, drawn-out process because then we realized, hey, actually, there's no pathway to purchase this land, so we could start cleaning it up, and we put a gazebo there, and we raise animals. We have chickens and ducks and peacocks, and we also raise fish. We have a tilapia farm and use that to water our farm. And then one year, one of our main plot that we were growing food on, it was sold to a developer who wanted to build a townhouse. And we had been working with the city, and the city was like, oh, we love what you're doing. Yes, continue to do it. We love that you're stewarding it. We don't have a pathway for you to purchase the land, but continue to do it. And we did, and then it was sold out as we started creating a beautiful space. It was sold. And so we were like, yeah, we need this land bank. Well, the land bank comes in, we get it passed, and then the land bank, we realized that the land bank actually was not being accountable to our community, to even the city. And so right now we're in the middle of a really big situation with the land bank, because we're saying we are going to hold you accountable, and we're as the city, we've hired you, and so you are going to, you know, you're going to do what you said that you were going to do. And then they come out with, they're like, yes, we will, and here's the 30-year mortgage. So there are all these things. They attached a 30-year mortgage to land acquisition by farms, and this 30-year mortgage is really stringent and has, like, you know, things in it that we're like, we can't, as communities, we can't even uphold these. And and it's not even legal. Half of the things aren't legal. So the land bank is one of the local community efforts that we have been focusing on.
And so, thank you for that. So I'll just maybe say, maybe food, as reporters, food, you can hear it in these comments, so deeply entwined with people's broader sense of identity and culture in ways that I think with other environmental issues, like, yes, for transportation, like, you've got your, like, biker crew who love bikes and, like, really, like, that is their identity, and I love the biker people, right? But I think it's hard. One of the reasons I always come back to food in my scholarship is because it is so deeply entwined. It, you know, it's hard to have a conversation with most people about transportation policy, right? But when you start to talk about food, everybody's got a story about food. And that story might be about culture and spirituality, that might be about tradition and economics. It might be about, you know, environmental injustice. I mean, the things that I'm just hearing here and so many more. And so I would just say being on the beat of food systems, it brings these broader questions of values, identity, and culture at the center. And that makes it really complicated and really difficult sometimes to find solutions that appeal to everybody, because there are often really conflicting value systems, conflicting priorities that folks bring to the fore. But there's also this opportunity for conversation that exists, because people will come in the door and have a conversation about food. So I think there's a lot of opportunity in using food as a lens to think about these broader climate environmental issues, but it's also dangerous because people get really connected to tradition and culture and preference. And then I'll just sort of say the last thing on this too is, you know, folks often think that their sort of decisions about food are their decisions, right? But the other piece of this is there's this huge infrastructure behind our individual decision making when it comes to food that has to do with corporate consolidation, that has to do with the neighborhoods we live in. And so oftentimes people say, you know, I eat X because Y. And that might be what they do in that moment, but there's so many decisions that get made before that individual consumer choice that gets made. And so that's another, I think, important story for journalists to tell, which is like, yeah, you know, are people choosing plant-based meat, right? Or are people choosing sustainable community seafood, right? That's an interesting question to ask, but also interesting to ask is, what are the broader infrastructures behind that either enable or constrain those decisions to be made at the grocery store, you know, at that local restaurant, or in our home kitchens?
Yeah, that's great. And I think, like, one of the things I know I have struggled with as a journalist is, you know, you've got this assignment, and it's sort of like on something happening in this area. And as soon as you start sort of digging in, there are all these threads that we're all mentioning, and it's sort of like, you know, then your editor's like, cool, can you just focus on the story? And you're like, but there's also, I need to get in this fact, and I know, like, now as an editor, I grapple with it, like, how many, you know, you don't want to sort of interrupt the flow of the story, but you also want to say, like, by the way, this is an impact that's, like, you should also know about. So that's, like, something I think that was part of why I wanted to have this panel, of, like, how do we tell these stories in ways that, like, are accurate, you know, we at Sentient have been doing more sort of rigorous solutions reporting, and it's kind of funny because last SEJ I was on a panel and I was like the solutions critic, even though it's not really accurate, but like I definitely have gone on some, like, you know, X whatever Twitter rants about solutions. Like, I think the stories there are just sort of like, you know, here's this, it's more of like a puff piece, I guess, just like in shorthand, but and without that really, like, scrutinizing the solution, and I've come to, like, really kind of double down and like the solutions journalism network pillars, because that forces you to sort of say, like, what is the evidence for this solution? Like, what are the, you know, what are the limitations? Because every solution has limitations. It's not going to solve everything, and that's fine, and actually that makes a better story, and that informs more reporting. So I think it's really important. And then there's, you know, insights. Like, if we were to scale this, that has to be the insight, but if we were to scale this, I think in food, like, what would that look like? Does it scale? Maybe it doesn't, and that's okay. So just kind of trying to, like, think through how the pillars or you know, it just happens to be one framework, but, like, how that can kind of, asking all these questions and having especially editors to ask these questions to, like, think about the framework at the beginning. So and for for me in food coverage, I have been, like, always had these, been focused on these sort of, like, global emissions numbers and been really, like, you know, concerned and want to see more stories about it. And at the same time, food is very personal, and I've always wanted to find these local stories that, like, connect that. And that's why I was, like, so excited to hear about, you know, Matt's work with Project Drawdown, because it was like, ah, food, and it's, like, a local story. Like, it's all the things I was looking for. So can you, like, give us one of, an example of one of those stories around food? Just, yeah.
It's, yeah. It's really interesting because there are there's so many different stories, and I think one thing that that we do so often, and by the way, Monica, thank you for your grounding, just to bring us really here, because it's so easy to want to talk about everything in a lot, but sometimes we really need to focus in, which is what I'm so thankful with the stories that we get to highlight through Drawdown's Neighborhood. And just as some context, like, the way that we identify those stories is really reaching out to communities and asking people within a city like Pittsburgh or New Orleans or, like, the San Francisco Bay Area or, the, you know, the tri-state area even, like, what, you know, who do you know who's doing this work, who should we know, and, you know, finding people who are recommended by so many other, dozens and dozens of other people, or who are surfaced through that process, or finding organizations surfaced through that process. But the person, or the story that comes to mind for me from New Orleans, which, like, as so many of us know, there's such a strong food culture. I asked folks there, what's the story of the city? And one person said, it's, you know, like, food, family, and friendship, or something like that. But food is so core to it. And I think of this one person, John Shell Johnson, who works as a farmer and educator at Grodat Youth Farm, which is a farm in New Orleans. And she spoke with me about, like, all of these things that we don't necessarily think about when we think about food and farms. So, for instance, as a Black woman herself, legacies of slavery and the ways that those influence our connection as Black people, or as, you know, as people who have experienced those legacies with the land. How does that influence how you show up? How does being a Black woman and a mom influence how you show up? She spoke about riding her bike to the community farm with one baby strapped to her front, one baby strapped on her back. And again, the self-sufficiency piece, the piece about preserving the food that is so core to us, things like gumbo and the like that are really core. John Shell talks about loving seafood. How do we still engage with those elements of our identities and of food while also embracing this food system? And if there's one thing that all of our Drawdown's Neighborhood stories, including John Shell's, have taught me, it's that we don't need to consider it an either or. We can preserve our culture. We can, you know, find ways to shift and do things in healthier ways. We can honor and recognize the histories of trauma, but also of superpowers and strengths that bring us to the table. And I'm just so thankful to be able to bring the full, help people unearth the fullness of their stories. I don't even know what the question was, but that's the answer. That's the answer.
Thank Amazing. You. No, it's good. Okay. Well, Malika, would you want to tell us a little bit about Soil Generation? What kind of, just a little bit about the program and, like, what it's addressing in the community.
All right. So, Soil Generation started years ago, and it began with Black and brown farmers. And we were just like, hey, we're all growing food, and let's get together. So it started off just getting together and bringing these growers together and communities of growers together. And then as these groups often do, we realize, hey, we got to deal with the policy stuff. The stuff that it's hard because, you know, we have to survive, so it's hard to, like, take all this time to, like, address the policy issues. But in starting to do that and focusing on land bank issues, we were able to be a part of the Urban Agriculture Plan, which came out of the struggle was to, there's actually a position now with the city, an official, like, urban agriculture position, and then this urban agriculture plan was created in conjunction with Interface Studios. So it was a two-year process, and in that process, we got to expand our outreach. We actually had funding to hire folks to be able to take the time that was needed to grow the connections with the community, and it was such a powerful experience. I remember our first urban agriculture gathering, because we were like, oh, you know, it's so much easier to create a plan when you don't have to consider hundreds of people's individual opinions. and yet that's not authentic, and that's not why we were chosen to be a part of the process. And so when we had this first gathering, the room was filled with about 400 food people. Everything from urban growers to farmers to chefs, to, like, all across the food system, folks were represented, attorneys. I mean, it was just phenomenal. And we got to work with these little groups, you know, and it was like in your table of eight, it would be everyone from, you know, all across the spectrum. And to be able to open that up and to be able to create this plan together with our community was so impactful. I encourage you all, check out the Urban Agriculture Plan. We couldn't get everything in there. We tried. it's funny, you were talking about, yeah, we want to do it, and then the editor is like, but no. So it was kind of like that. We were like, yeah, all of the things, and no. And we're like, but yes, we're going to do it. So that's part of why it took actually a year longer than we had anticipated, because we were like, how do we do this? We got to keep this balance and authentically represent. So I think that would be one of the main things that came out of Soil Generation.
Okay, great. So, Garrett, I was going to ask you about Respect Farms in the Netherlands, and you can still talk about it, but also I keep thinking about just, like, how, like, when I've interviewed you over the years, it's been because, I think, as someone who, like, I did a lot of plant-based meat company coverage, cultivated meat company coverage, and I think I was always very interested in, like, where, you know, is it just, like, is there something beyond this kind of coverage in terms of, like, where is the sort of community aspect? Is there something that addresses workers or pollution? Like, how can I, like, essentially, if I'm interested in environmental justice or climate justice, how can I cover this? Like, can I cover this area even?
Yeah.
Are there stories out there that are ripe for that?
Yeah, no, Jenny and I have sort of been fellow travelers on the alt meat beat for a while now, and have seen the ups and downs and a lot of really hyperbolic coverage, which you speak to both on the solutions side and also the, like, this is the worst thing ever side, for both meat and meat alternatives. And so I do think, just to your kind of your previous framing, like, there's a lot of food cover, I call it sort of like the Netflixification of food media, that it's like, everything that you thought you knew about food is wrong, and here's the big solution, and it's going to be that, you know, and I see it from both the high tech, right? Like, hey, you know, we're going to have these plant-based burgers, and that's going to be the end of, you know, environmental problems in the food system. But also, actually, the truth is that the soil microbes are going to be this perfect solution, and if we just rotate our livestock, that's going to solve everything too. And I think anytime someone is sort of pitching this simple solution, this solves the problem, just no, it's just not the way it goes. And so the reality is there's a lot of complexity in all these systems, and there are, I think, and one of the things I've been trying to do in my research and also in the collaborative work that I do, I'm on the board of a nonprofit, for instance, called the Plant-Based Foods Institute, is try to see where are these intersections where we might have elements that have technological solution aspects, but that are also bridging that with community engagement and community development. So you mentioned a couple that are kind of emerging in the cell-cultured meat world. So this is the lab-grown meat stuff, which is still very far away from being like a real thing that could ever be in restaurants and grocery stores. But yeah, there's this project in the Netherlands that was actually one of the daughter of one of the kind of initial founders of this whole idea of cell-cultured meat is developing this kind of pilot program where they're working with Dutch farmers to kind of transition them from livestock farming to being kind of the future, cultivated meat farmers of the world. There's another project in the Los Angeles area called O-Meat, where they're actually have their own livestock and are using these livestock to kind of provide the medium that would feed these cell cultures. It's actually, I would imagine, quite controversial in some of the animal rights community aspect of it, because they're still using animals, although it's in this kind of, harm-free way. But there's also, I think, really interesting stuff happening and a lot of potential in the plant-based world to link agriculture to plant-based and to link particularly kind of more sustainable forms of agriculture. Right now, so much of the plant-based meat products, plant-based meat alternatives, really just depend on a very traditional, conventional agricultural supply chain. There's like literally one pea protein supplier. It's called Purus. And they supply like all of the pea protein in all of North America, like 90%+. And how can we, move beyond that, right? That can have some really good outcomes for taste as well, right? If we're all just using like the same pea protein, that's why anytime you hear like these plant-based meats, like, we figured out this perfect extrusion process and it's going to be so different. It's like, well, you're still using like the exact same pea protein as that other company. They're not going to probably taste all that different. So what could we do in terms of really unlocking like flavor from different types of agricultural products, different types of seeds, but then, of course, getting farmers involved in this process. So Plant-Based Foods Institute, as I mentioned, I'm on the board of, they're launching a new initiative focused on a kind of sustainable supply chain and building this community of practice that bring together industry and suppliers and farmers in these conversations about, like, what's possible. How can this deliver, good outcomes for farmers, also have this positive environmental benefit? And most importantly, and you can't get too far away from this, and I think this is sometimes a challenge for reporters and academics who focus on this stuff, it's got to taste good, right? If the food doesn't taste good, nobody's interested in your food and climate solution. And so starting with taste and the pleasure, the gustatory pleasure of food, if you move too far away from that, you're not gonna have a chance to make a really big impact. So that's why we also have to bring the food, the flavor, the chefs. As much as I don't always love to have chefs be, I'm biased against sometimes chefs who say they're the ones. They're another one who's like, I figured out the solution. I'm the chef, right? It's not just the chef, but they're an important part of that process. Sorry, chefs catching astray. I apologize. But anyway, I think there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of ways to tell this story as journalists. It's not just like, is plant-based meat the future? Or is plant-based meat actually killing us all? There's a lot of nuance, a lot of opportunities for these kind of collaborative engagements.
Awesome. And then, Fanny, can you tell us about Fishadelphia? And, like, I was particularly struck, I think, by some of the, well, just the ways in which, like, people can sort of pay at a scale to be able to,
I can, so I guess I'll kind of start with the origin story that we like to tell often is Fishadelphia was founded by someone named Talia Young, and she actually taught high school science in Philly for many years and then went to get a fisheries PhD, and she was at a conference where they were talking about sort of the problem I introduced at the beginning of the panel about just sort of how backwards the seafood supply chain is. And someone stood up and said, well, the problem is that Americans only know how to eat salmon and cod fillets. And in her head, she was like, well, I don't think you're talking to all Americans. you know, she grew up in New York going to Chinatown, where you see all different kinds of whole fish. You see jellyfish, abalone, sea cucumber, and then she also has, you know, black friends from the South or from the Caribbean, who also just know how to, yeah, have deep knowledge about how to prepare fish. And these were the people in her life who had actually, like, the most expertise in seafood. And then at the same time, you know, we are not too far from New Jersey, where, you know, people think of the Jersey Shore, they just think about, you know, like, the mega mansions and the tourism. But actually, there, you know, there are coastal communities that have been there, that have been fishing for generations, you know, and there have also been people that have, you know, have been there since time immemorial and that have also been displaced. But, you know, these coastal communities, they're rural in the wintertime, and then, you know, the population explodes in the summertime. But these fishing communities in New Jersey, they're often landing fish that gets shipped abroad. So dogfish, for instance, that a lot of that gets shipped to the UK, actually, for fish and chips. Parts of, like, the belly gets shipped to Germany, where it's a delicacy, and parts of it get shipped to Asia. Same thing with skate wings. So she saw this opportunity. It's like, why are these fishing communities that are, like, an hour away sending their fish abroad? And then, meanwhile, there are all these diverse communities in Philly who have this, like, really deep cultural knowledge about how to break down a whole fish in their kitchens, how to prepare fish, like, unfamiliar species. And so it really started as a way to sort of bridge that and make that connection. And it also started because she was a high school teacher at a local high school in South Philly. So the students were literally, like, handling raw fish, like, in the teacher's lounge after school, like, weighing it into, like, one-pound portions. And, like, you know, it was just this, like, wild experiment that has been able to persist since 2017, 2018, when it started. And one thing that is also really special about it is because it was founded with the intention of bringing seafood to culturally and socioeconomically diverse communities, the sliding scale is a big part of it. And so there are four different price points that people can pay for the exact same share of fish. And then there's a small, what we call the neighbor share program, which actually provides free fish to families. And so, yeah, that's the business model, is that, you know, neighbors are subsidizing local fresh seafood for other neighbors. And I think that, you know, it's another way that of relating to your food too, of using it as a vehicle to sort of, like, practice solidarity with your neighbors. And I think, you know, because some people are paying, they're paying a lot for a pound of fish. I think our highest tier is, like, $48 for a pound of seafood if you're paying the higher ends of the sliding scale. And I think at that level, then, you know, the seafood also, even if you have a lot of means, like, the seafood is a treat too. You know, it's something that you are, and I think that you're kind of, it's a way of engaging with the food where you are saying, like, I'm honoring this fish. And you know, one thing I think that has happened with seafood is that we've come to sort of expect just a few species at all times of the year, no matter where we are, like I said. And I think with having been part of Fishadelphia for a while now, you start to get into the rhythm of, like, certain species are available in certain seasons or with certain migration cycles. And so not just expecting that it's this source of food that is, like, on demand and available all the time, but kind of, yeah, for me, you know, I love seafood, and I think that with the Fishadelphia shares, they've become something that I really see as, like, a treat and something to be treasured too. And it deepens my connection with a sense of place. And, you know, I don't live on the ocean, but even I'll think about how the waters in our rivers, in the Schuylkill and the Delaware rivers, they flow into the waters that these fish live in. And so there is that sense of connection.
So we want to talk a little bit about sort of, like, the challenges in covering food, but also, do people have questions now? Because we can also, yeah, like, we can do that.
So I'm going to, like, walk out. And let me say, I was, like,
warned 17 times on these things. So, okay, like, I'm going to prioritize journalists asking questions and also say your name and where you're from.
Thank you all so much. My name is Melina. I cover agriculture for the Associated Press. And my question is, I've heard this narrative a lot, I think, mainly from industry, but also, like, from researchers or historians, that with the climate crisis, that we have to have scale and that we have to have kind of industrial agriculture because it's the most efficient way to feed a growing population, or however you want to phrase that. And I wonder how you kind of square that with these efforts to also make food more local or to connect people with the stories of their food. You know, how do you think about that? Is that something you think is true? Or,
yeah. I definitely have thoughts, but does anyone else want to start?
I mean, I think, you know, the focus on efficiency and scale, I mean, it hasn't solved our problems yet, right? I guess starting there with the Green Revolution and every, you know, I think still, I don't remember the number, but it's, and I think it's contested, but a large portion of the world is still fed by small-scale food producers, and the ways that we have scaled up in industrialized food production has led to tons of costs, right, with the synthetic fertilizers and pesticides and food access, arguably, too. And so I think when people talk about efficiency, there are often a lot of, like, costs that people are not talking about. One of those costs I think that a lot of us are talking about on this panel is also, like, the loss of connection to land and water. So I think also thinking about the harder to quantify things that are both lost and also the things that are gained with other forms of food production that are more rooted in community and people. So even when you think about, like, urban agriculture, you know, local urban farms, you know, can't necessarily feed the entire city by numbers, or they may not be, like, the most low carbon way to produce food. I know there was a big study that came out in January that argued that, you know, urban farms are actually have a bigger carbon footprint. I know that there's also people have debunked that in various ways, but, you know, but then what are you gaining when it comes to these forms of food production too, right? And so, you know, food is a way for people to share knowledge between generations, as a way for people to connect, to come together around shared struggles with land in a city, a way for people to connect with their land, or, you know, immigrants and refugees who come from agrarian cultures and have been torn from their homes, and now they're, like, recreating a home by having a relationship with the land. Like, all of these sort of harder to quantify sort of costs and benefits really get lost when you're just focusing on, like, the numbers of efficiency.
Just to build on that, there's so much, like, I should say that Project Drawdown's mission is to stop climate change as quickly, safely, and equitably as possible. And yet, at the same time, not everything is about, or not all the interventions, not all the ways people show up directly need to be about stopping climate change or have that as the number one priority. And we know from a lot of the Yale Climate Opinion polling over the years that climate isn't the number one thing that people are thinking of or caring about day to day. Health, family, jobs, all these things come above climate for people. And so I think what's really powerful to recognize is just that, like, it's okay that people are putting those things first and benefiting in those ways while also developing habits that are, you know, maybe on the community farm they're not solving climate change or making a big impact when it comes to emissions in some cases, but developing habits that prepare them for the future that does better integrate systemic climate solutions, prepare them for a future where people do have the ability to support themselves on plant-based diets and the like. And something I was reflecting on before this was just what are a lot of the benefits that I've heard about from people through the Drawdown's Neighborhood series, and why do they do this work? Well, there's so much joy that they get in this work. There's removing roadblocks. There's improving communities today, which I think is an important one, because sometimes I've heard this question from people, typically really wealthy people who've asked, is it worth it? Like, are we actually going to stop climate change? And I have to say to them, what I'm seeing day to day, what so many of you are seeing day to day, is that the climate solutions and climate interventions that are happening now are improving lives, are saving lives in so many cases, and that to me makes it all worth it. But, you know, there's learning skills. I mentioned the self-sufficiency before, connecting with tools and resources, centering our own needs and having community ownership, honoring history. All these things matter, and I think especially, like, the reason why they're so front and center for me, other than just my own identities, is that in centering who people are, they bring up all of these things often before they bring up the, you know, will this solve climate change? That's, you know, that's not what so many people on the ground are focused on, but especially the folks that I've been able to connect with and highlight. And I think that's a beautiful thing, realizing that there's so many other benefits to solutions in our communities.
I think, like, also as journalists, we have to be kind of, especially if you're on the food beat, you have to kind of go beyond these, like, either-or framing, like, and also be thinking about, like, the context in the U.S. And does it make, like, you know, what is going to work in Iowa, in Iowa isn't going to, you know, be the same for another country where people are still mostly getting their food from small farmers. But in the U.S., you have this, like, huge industrial ag system. Most of the animals, you know, that are farmed in the U.S., like, 99% of them are factory farmed. And when we're looking at emissions, like, so when we're looking at emissions, it's like food system emissions. It's mostly coming from beef. Like, so when we talk about, like, efficiency in industrial ag, like, what are we talking about? Like, if we all did this, like, super, you know, it's tomorrow. Well, not tomorrow. It's a whole other little, you know, penalty to avoid. But just, like, if we were to shift to, you know, like, industrially produced tofu, like, we would save a lot of land. And, you know, we wouldn't have the cattle. You know, and also just, like, what do we mean by efficiency, right? Like, efficiency has given us, like, super cheap chicken that's fed lots of people, but also it's pretty bad for the chickens, right? Like, I don't think that's, like, a super controversial point, just, like, on those, like, intensive factory farms. But so I think what's really would be helpful for readers is to kind of get some of that, like, complexity, right? Like it's okay to say, like, yeah, chickens lower in emissions, you know, and it's fed a lot of people, and it's affordable, and that's important. And also, like, this is what it looks like for chicken and the pollution of the communities. Like, we could just sort of, like, bring in, you know, if you have an editor who lets you, bring in some of these different, I think, points. Anyone else want to?
I was just thinking about, like, how much vacant land is just in Philadelphia alone, right? And, like, imagine if these barriers were removed and you could just go and grow, just giving ourselves a moment to imagine what that would look like.
I would just say it comes back to kind of my initial comments, and the question I would ask is, like, what is food for, right? So is food simply a vehicle to provide a bare minimum caloric intake to feed the planet? I think most of us would say probably not, right? Food is also about family. It's about enjoyment. It's about pleasure. It's about those community connections that can come from these kinds of things. So yeah, you know, if you're talking to an ag economist who's generally optimizing for the caloric, you know, production, then yes, then they're going to really prioritize and say, what are these, you know, community gardens providing? But if you're talking to one of those community gardeners who will probably say, yeah, I still, you know, go to ShopRite for a lot of my groceries, but the thing that I love most are the, you know, couple bunches of kale that I get from my garden and the neighbors that I've met and the community that I've built, you know, that has value too. And so I will say I spend a lot of time, this is one of those, like, it depends what room I'm in. So if I'm in the room with a bunch of ag economists, I'm the one making the case for why local, you know, alternative approaches have value. But if I'm in the room sometimes with a lot of the folks who are just deeply in the small local, I sort of have to, you know, remind them that even by their own metrics, it doesn't match that scale for the kind of demands that we have, you know, locally, nationally, and internationally. I also think there is often a very kind of US-centric assumption built into the way we think about this. And, you know, there's a lot of places around the world where getting access to basic industrial scale-up strategies and tools is really vital for securing food, making food security a thing. Now, that shouldn't be independent of other structural, social changes that also need to go on at the same time. But, yeah, back to Jenny's point, like, resisting this either-or, talking about the different values that they bring, and also, like, why not both? You know, like, some days I like to, you know, go to a grocery store and buy a, you know, I have some processed food in my diet, right? And, like, that's okay. But also, like, I like to go to the farmer's market and have that connection and know where this is coming from, right? And I think that kind of hybrid future food system is the thing that is going to help us meet a lot of our climate goals, meet kind of the broader cultural goals that our food, you know, that we want our food to bring. And so how do we depolarize this debate, I think is a real challenge, and I think journalists have a really important role to play there.
Hey, my name's Kate Morgan. I'm a freelancer. So this is a little bit of a two-parter, but I'll try to keep it simple. So if the answer then ultimately is no, we don't need, however you define need, we don't need industrial farming. Part one is like, what are the major hurdles then to getting beyond it? Whether that's this, you know, demand of I need shrimp all year, everywhere, or you know, other things of that nature. The kind of second half of this question is, how do we define industrial scale farming? What does that look like? Because I don't know that the opposite is always just a garden and a vacant lawn. I think it's a debate.
Well, we do define industrial and community-based in one of the orgs I work for at North American Marine Alliance. I don't know if this is, maybe Garrett won't love this definition, but, and I shared this at my workshop on Wednesday too, but we kind of, when we talk about industrial, we talk about it as related to the degrees of separation between who owns the operation and who is actually touching the fish. And so a really industrialized seafood supply chain has many degrees of separation, whereas, and the sort of foil to that is community-based. We define community-based as the harvesters are harvesting in the communities that they live in, and they're on the waters every day. They're ecological experts of their home waters. So that's sort of how we like to think about it. I think it gets to one of those costs of efficiency is the corporate consolidation, and sort of like just the way that our economics are structured, which also feeds into the global inequity that sort of makes people in some countries dependent on industrial sort of like food aid. And another cost is that just that people become disconnected from how food is produced. Or even if you're not producing the food yourself, it's still, you know, you have that connection if you know the person that grew your food because they're your, like, local farmer or local fisherman that you actually know or is your neighbor or something like that. So, yeah, that's how we think about it, the degrees of separation.
Garrett, do you love that or not love that?
You know, industrial agriculture, it is kind of a floating signifier, and a lot of times people who have, you know, are critics of industrial agriculture will often just use it to mean whatever they don't like about agriculture. Obviously, I think a big element is scale, that is a big part of it, and with scale comes that disconnection, but also with scale comes the ability to, you know, feed cities, right? And so I don't necessarily think, like, we need to end all forms of industrial agriculture if we're defining that as a large scale, a suite of technologies and practices that allow for the large scale production and distribution of food across, you know, towns, cities, nations, and globally. I think maybe if we could go back to, like, the original position, like, would we start, you know, and build the system that we have? Probably not. I mean, in really interesting ways, if you look at the history of the Green Revolution, for instance, and the population growth that has happened in the last 80 years, the industrialization of agriculture has sort of enabled the population growth that we see, and so it's really hard to kind of put that genie back in the bottle. So I think for those reasons, yeah, I don't think that, you know, I think there would be a lot of suffering, honestly, if we were to completely move away from large-scale industrial agriculture entirely. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't also at the same time be promoting these alternatives that can provide, you know, those values and looking for ways to make that more affordable and more accessible. I forgot the second part of your question.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this is the thing that I think people don't quite get, is that I would say, like, I would even just say, like, almost all, like, factory farm owners are also, like, family farms. Because, like, because even if it's technically a corporation, or even if it's technically a contract farmer for Purdue, it's almost certain that, like, your family did that. Like, it's, right, going back for generations. So, we struggle with this a lot, because, it's like, people know the term factory farm. People know, so it's like, we kind of, like, in every story, can't be like, here's the entire history of why we use this term. I actually did kind of go into it a little bit in this SEJ tip sheet I did, but, like, yeah, but, I mean, I think, in a way, the framing also gets fraught, because, yes, there are actual people who run these operations, and I think this also came up a lot in the disinfo panel. It's like, I don't see a lot of, I don't think that a lot of farmers are like, mwahaha, let me, like, spread this misinformation. It's just that, like, the industry is, and that's, I think, goes back to, I think maybe you said, of, like, what are the systems in place that are, like, kind of keeping us, you know, that keep things in the status quo. And I think one of the things is, like, yeah, like, big, like, these farmers feel under attack, rightly or wrongly, you can talk about that, but, like, they will then go to places to be like, please, academic scientist who's, like, you know, getting a whole lot of industry PR funding, like, tell me the science that I can use so that I can defend myself on social media. So it's like, I think there's a lot of things going on, which is a lot of stories to tell, which is good for us. But yeah, we can illuminate that complexity.
I think population is a big one, right? And just demand. Yeah, but I'm not calling for that, right? But, you know, I think demand is something that I've found over the years. I've become less of a believer that it's all a supply issue, that demand does play a role here, and that we do see, for instance, with, you know, global economic development, we see increased demand for meat in particular, right? And I think there is a kind of, like, critical Marxist perspective that I was maybe brought up in academia that says, like, no, there's no such thing as demand. Like, that's just completely created by the supply side and then through marketing, et cetera. I've come away from that by looking over the years at what actually happens and talking to people about what they eat and how they eat and why they eat. So I think it starts with, like, there's a lot of people on this planet who demand a lot of things, and you know, some of that stuff is that we've got accustomed to, and maybe there are opportunities for culture change to change those preferences. But it's a really big, especially given the immediacy of a lot of our climate challenges, to expect that demand shift can happen rapidly, I think is almost its own kind of, like, solutionist pipe dream that goes alongside some of these techno solutions, right? And so, I know I keep coming back to this place, but, like, why not end? You know, yes, end as a hope. A
couple questions here. Oh, okay, I'll go over here. You raised your hand first. You want to go first?
Right. Hi. I'm Alejandro Figueroa. I'm a food and agriculture reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting. I kind of have a question to your point about how farmers feel maybe attacked or villainized. And, you know, that is how would you suggest balancing a climate solution story or agriculture story so that it serves communities in urban and rural communities in a way that people can find, like, a common ground on both sides and not alienate one part of that story, which is rural communities. And I ask that because I'm still very new in this meet. I've been covering this for just 3 months. But a question that has come up very recently and almost constantly when I talk with rural sources is, well, are you going to cover this story from the viewpoint of Portland or, you know, the rest of the state or Oregon? And I've been trying to find some
it's so interesting. I don't have a full answer to that question, but I, you know, like sometimes I'm interviewed about the work that I do at Project Drawdown or just about my story, and someone asked me at one point, what's the story that you're trying to tell going into, I think this might have been going into the New Orleans series, and I was caught off guard a little bit because I said, well, there's not a story that I'm trying to tell. You know, we find people who are doing work that is somehow aligned with these science-backed, data-backed climate solutions that we have, but it's really giving the people the space to share their story as people, share why they're doing what they're doing, share the work that they're doing, share, you know, the science and the impacts on the local level. And something that I've found, that I've even been, I think, you know, any of us who's been covered in this story could recognize this, that, like, if someone is going in trying to shape a story and tell a certain message, then you're not fully represented. I'm thinking of, like, an interview I did that was an hour long, and they took away, like, the 45-second soundbite that was not at all the point of what I was saying. And I'm thinking, well, then why am I even showing up? Because it's not authentically representing what I'm saying at all. It's trying to get the sound, but it's trying to make a point. And so, you know, my immediate reaction to what you're saying is, well, one, you know, the pace of things works against all of us when we're working to tell a story that has a certain point that we want to make. By next week, you know, it's really hard to sit down and give people the space to fully authentically represent who they are, what they're saying. But I think that that's the answer, is not trying to shape a story, but instead giving space for a story to actually come out and be represented and heard.
And it's okay for there to be, like, yeah, like, there isn't one voice that's, like, the farmer. I mean, you know, yeah, that, I'm not telling you. But, like, it's just, like, in general, I think that's a good thing to keep in mind. Like, I've been covering ag since, like, it, not just not climate, but, like, ag specifically, like, since, I think, 26 years, like, but like, I feel like the more, like, I never feel like I really have a handle on, like, agriculture, just the U.S., forget outside of the U.S., I don't even know, but it's, I feel like it's just, yeah, it's like ranchers over here are like, oh, those, like, southeastern U.S. ranchers, like, there's so much, that's real, like, there's just, like, yeah, like, there's a lot of, like, little interesting cultural things. I actually kind of want to do a panel on just, like, farmers for, and how to interview them and everything for next year, because I think there's a lot.
I'll add a little to that too. Just, yeah, I think y'all know this as journalists, but just sort of separating the individual from the structures and the systems that they're in. And, you know, the NAMA, we're a sister org with the Family Farm Coalition, National Family Farm Coalition. So I do get to talk to a lot of family farmers, and I was in Indiana last year, and a lot of the family farmers there are, like you said, they're you know, producing at an industrial scale, they're growing commodity crops, and it's something that they had to do to survive. You know, they're put in this system that forces them in that direction, and so you can tell those stories where you're humanizing the individuals and the choices they've had to make, while also, you know, having a critical take on the systems that they're in. Yeah.
No, I just said well said.
Yeah.
I agree.
I have a question that might actually, like, tie these two together. My name is Karen.
Hi.
I wrote a book about bluefin tuna, so I want to talk to you about more later. And it's looking at these systems. So, culture change. So, one of the earliest stories I did on food systems was about Jessica B. Harris, who came to the Food Waste Symposium, and she's been around forever. But when High on the Hog came out on Netflix, all of a sudden she's this, like, global celebrity. So very often, like, the information is out there on all of these beats, you know, whether it's agriculture, seafood, food waste, whatever. So talking about culture shift for all of you, what are, like, pieces of media? Who's doing it best? How do we, because obviously pace, the pace of thing works against all of us. That's such, like, a wise, beautiful thing. But, like how do we, climate is happening so quickly, culture and systems move slowly. So what are, like, the most hopeful, exciting stuff that's, like, solving for that right now for all of you?
Culture change is sort of your...
Yeah.
Well, so much, right. I think just being in it and doing what I love and sharing that and again, that's why I love what you all do too, because you have an opportunity to share these messages even broader. Recently we were able to get a grant to build a multimedia studio at One Art, and I was so excited because I'm like, finally, you know, we're going to be able to share this message even just more broadly. And we built the studio off of the African proverb, when the lions tell their story, the hunters will no longer be the heroes. And so we just have to keep sharing.
I'll just add, and I love that question you asked, Karen, because it is, like, I wish that there were more platforms, more storytellers, more journalists even covering this and realizing that there are, like, each of us has the power to connect with our spheres of influence to help them understand and hear these stories. They're out there. I mean, the work that I do with Drawdown's Neighborhood is a great example. All these people are out there, want to share their stories, but the platforms out there aren't covering that. And I'm thankful, like in the case of our work, for example, that Drawdown's Neighborhood is distributed by the Weather Channel's streaming network pattern. But I'm like, why isn't it on, you know, network TV? Why? And not necessarily saying my work needs to be, but why aren't we? Make it happen. But no, it's like, it's you know, why aren't we telling these stories? And there are a lot of reasons why we don't tell these really important, practical, meaty stories and instead preference others. And so I don't have a solution to that, but the stories are out there, as we all know, right? And you all have the ability to amplify them.
Just a little plug for, like, collaborations, like, solutions collaborations. We've got one in the works at Sentient that we're very excited about with different newsrooms in. I think there's a lot more of that happening with smaller outlets like us. Like, we're in a niche, but we can, you know, partner with other folks and, like, something like a Nexus, which can, like, then get us syndicated in these bigger outlets. Like, that's kind of what we're looking towards. I mean, we just started it, so we don't have our evidence of it. But I think that's, yeah, what we're excited about.
Can I also briefly, so on the topic of culture change, I don't want to put you on the spot, Malika, but I don't know if you want to talk about agroecology, because I know a lot of farmers, in terms of culture change, a lot of farmers I know are really energized by that movement, and I think that that's potentially something exciting to talk about too.
Yeah, I mean, again, just creating more platforms for the sharing to happen, and people want to talk about their culture. It's a part of their lives. It's a part of their legacy. It's they want to share stories of their ancestors. They want to, in the work that we do with the land, we're reconnecting. And so we can't ignore this powerful connection that is happening. And the more we teach it and provide opportunities, especially for our young people, to be able to experience this in a non-judgmental way. You know, you were talking a little earlier about there's so much trauma in our Black communities historically with the land. And so to be able to create these safe spaces where you can come and have that experience and grow that relationship non-judgmentally in your own time, tomato by tomato, and experience by experience.
We actually, like, are almost at time. I'm trying to squeeze in a few more questions.
Hi, my name is Sarah. Sorry, I'm very short, but I'm over here. I work at the Greenville News in Greenville, South Carolina. I cover 11 upstate counties, which encompasses a lot of agriculture and also a lot of development. Very, very broad, but one of the things I would love to get y'all's input on is kind of how food insecurity and food deserts also relate to this conversation of holistic food systems. I've seen the hypothesis since starting this be that as, like, climate continues to change, that food deserts and food insecurity can become more severe. There's also kind of what Garrett mentioned about, like, food beyond just like meeting a caloric need, like just generally how we kind of integrate conversations about nutrition education, food insecurity, food access, and how that relates to climate change, culture, and just like a whole network of food reporting overall.
Real quickly, one of the shifts that we have been promoting and considering is just the change in the terminology from food desert, because a desert is a naturally occurring, right, to food apartheid. And in this shift, the whole paradigm changes. So that just, you know.
Yeah, and I would just add, I've been kind of following the anti-food desert work for a long time, and I'm using that term intentionally because there is, a history of a lot of projects that are just like, well, we have this food desert, let's bring in some water, right? Like, let's bring in some food, and that'll change things. And those have been shown to, like, fail over and over and over again. And so, and this also connects to the previous question on culture change, which is that, like, we can't expect that just information alone, that just getting this info out, that just building a grocery store alone is going to be enough. Like, that's kind of necessary, but not sufficient. We also need to be doing a lot of work that's building these kind of stronger tie networks that are bringing different institutions together, right? So the initiatives that do work, to combat food insecurity and promote food justice and combat food apartheid are those that are not just about food. I wrote a book called More Than Just Food, so that's really about this kind of work. They're often integrated into broader networks of community organizing, some of which are related to food and some of which are related to totally other issues, whether it's environmental issues, whether it's, you know, employment, whether it's social entrepreneurship. And so those are the solutions that I have a lot of optimism about, are those that kind of think more at the community level, that have like a grocery store as part of it, but it's that grocery store that's also connected to these other community institutions, community organizations, and this really important role that local and ethnic media are playing in telling those stories and making sure that folks are aware of what those resources are and feel comfortable to be able to connect to those institutions, right? Making sure, for instance, that that grocery is selling the types of food that that local community actually wants, which unfortunately is often not the case.
Just one quick comment I would add is that so often, not only the stories and news coverage, but also the research that we do, what we highlight, focuses on the problem and focuses on the victimhood of communities. There's incredible power, there's incredible perspective, there are incredibly unique contributions that the communities have to make. And so when I think about the stories of food insecurity, of food deserts, I also just want to also make the point that we have to be so careful not to just tell those stories and paint these communities, black and brown communities primarily, as victims, when not only are we not victims, but like survivors, first and foremost, but also we can be heroes if afforded the resources to actually do that.
Great. Well, come up and find us if you have more questions. I don't want to, like, hold everyone hostage here, but, like, but round of applause for all of our speakers. Everyone's great. And you guys, great questions.
Thank you.